Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your host is humbled by the people who subscribe to this program, and I'd like to thank Susan Fellows, David Pennell, Deborah Newell, and Stuart Smith for being loyal subscribers. Our bonus book offer continues for new subscribers. Get the details at peterbcollins.com. In the second portion of this podcast, we'll meet author James Olson, and we're going to talk about left-brain, right-brain dominant individuals and how those left-brainers tend to be conservatives and pro-war. His book is called The Whole Brain Path to Peace. That's coming up a little bit later in this podcast. But first, we welcome back to our program. He was here just a week ago. One of the best reporters covering our war policies and related issues in recent years, Gareth Porter, a journalist and historian. Gareth, welcome back today.
Hello again, Peter.
And since we last spoke, you published a very powerful investigative piece at truthout.org. It appeared on May 3rd. And we will link to that article in the show file at peterbcollins.com. And you offer a very different reading of the documents that were collected in Abbottabad, Pakistan, a year ago at the conclusion of the incident where Osama bin Laden reportedly died. And I want to dive into those documents and some of the other issues. But first, let's cover the baseline. This is a very carefully orchestrated release of some of the documents. The Washington Post, for example, in a story that was syndicated to other newspapers today on Friday, May 4th, cites 17 documents that they were allowed to review at the Combating Terrorism Center of the West Point website. What is the scope of the release to date of documents, and would you think that, or would you characterize this as a carefully orchestrated, selective release of this information?
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. The White House and the administration have released only a tiny little sprinkle of documents, which essentially are the ones that they feel are most likely to cast positive glow on their policy and on the whole business of killing bin Laden. I think that, you know, one of their major purposes, of course, was to try to suggest two things. One, that bin Laden, was out to kill the president and Petraeus. That was one of the things that they leaked months and months ago,
right,
to David Ignatius, as well as to, I think it's Associated Press, if I remember correctly. But in any case, nothing, you know, no new story there. These are the documents that they want to use to show that, you know, bin Laden really was a powerful character who was, a dangerous terrorist, and therefore, you know, the killing of bin Laden was really a great accomplishment. And the second thing I think they were out to show with these documents was that al-Qaeda had been gravely weakened, and that bin Laden and his folks were clearly impressed by the degree to which they had lost influence around the world because of the great counterterrorism policy of the United States. So, those are the themes that I think they intended to have come out in these 17 documents. And by the way, I mean, these are the same 17 documents that are available to everybody. The Post didn't have exclusive look at this. These were on the website of the Counterterrorism Center of the West Point.
Right. And Gareth, one of the places where I feel we need to start here is with some skepticism for the various versions that we have heard, some about the specifics of the raid in Abbottabad, and others, and you told me before we started recording today, that the comments posted by readers at Truth Out largely focus on whether they believe that the raid is when Osama bin Laden actually died. And because our government has been misleading, lying, and dissembling in many respects since 9/11 and certainly well before on other issues, there is a healthy skepticism among thinking people about what we're being told. And so fundamentally, tell me what you believe, because David Ray Griffin wrote a book that purports to show that bin Laden was killed in Tora Bora in December of 2001. Benazir Bhutto, before she was assassinated, in at least two interviews, alluded to her belief that at that time in 2007, that she believed that Osama bin Laden was already dead. Now, I do believe that he's dead now. I don't know when he died, though, and I am perhaps a victim of the same kind of speculation and doubt that was reflected by the posts on Truth Out.
Well, I'm glad you've really raised this more fundamental question, Peter, because I think it is really a serious problem for the progressive movement in this country that one of the things that has happened, you correctly, I think, characterized it as people not believing anything that is being said politically or publicly by the U.S. government, the national security state, and I think that's quite appropriate. The question is, where does this, what you called healthy skepticism, verge on the inability or unwillingness to try to find out what the truth is and to simply assume that the truth is the opposite somehow of whatever is said publicly in a general sense, so that, you know, if it is stated that bin Laden was killed in Abbottabad, then the skeptic will automatically say, no, he had to be killed earlier. This has to be a lie. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no question that virtually everything that was said about the raid itself was a lie. I mean, you know, they lied about bin Laden resisting with a gun.
Yes.
That he'd hidden behind his wife, so on and so forth. Every single statement that was made practically in briefing reporters turned out to have been a lie. And I would say the same thing, you know, in terms of what I wrote about in my story for Truth Out. They lied about the background to the discovery of bin Laden at Abbottabad. Mm-hmm. The whole story that the CIA used its interrogation of detainees to find out about bin Laden's courier, and then that was the critical thing that led them to Abbottabad. Of course, that's a lie, used by some very unscrupulous people who were supporting the use of torture against detainees to try to justify that in part. And then, of course, they lied about the degree to which bin Laden was really in control of anything.
Yeah.
I think it's quite clear, even from the limited group of documents that have been released to the public that you alluded to earlier, that bin Laden was putting forward all these ideas about what he wanted al-Qaeda to do. For example, blow up a president's plane or Petraeus's plane. But these were idle ideas. These were the sort of meanderings of someone who was really quite isolated. And what I show in my article is that the reason he was isolated is that bin Laden had been ousted from the leadership of the al-Qaeda Shura in 2003. And this is information which comes from people in the tribal area of West Pakistan, northwest Pakistan, who were couriers themselves for the tribal leader who was the head of Tehrik-e-Pakistan, the Pakistani the Pakistani radical group that was allied with al-Qaeda, but in an uneasy alliance, as we see from those documents. And what we learn from these couriers, courtesy of Shaukat Qadir, a former Pakistani brigadier general, retired brigadier general, who did all this spade work himself independently, and which I was able to take advantage of in my story, is that the al-Qaeda shura became somewhat alarmed and ultimately very tired of bin Laden's ranting about the necessity of al-Qaeda attacking the Quetta nuclear site in Pakistan, mm-hmm. insisting that that had to be a major target for al-Qaeda, despite the fact that it was pointed out to him time and again that this was an impenetrable target guarded by large numbers of troops and other electronic means. And besides that, there was no nuclear weapons there anyway. It was simply a nuclear reactor, and they said it doesn't make any sense, and he refused to listen to them. So finally, they decided that he'd simply become a nuisance, and besides that, he was physically incapacitated, had to be moved time and again by horseback or carried on somebody's back from one place to another within Pakistan, where he'd fled after the 2001 Tora Bora battle.
Mm-hmm.
And So basically what they wanted to do is ease him out of his position where he was actually making the fundamental decisions for the organization, and move him to Abbottabad, where he would be not in a position to really ride herd on the rest of the shura or insist on his point of view. And that's exactly, I think, what emerges from the documents that we've seen quoted.
And Gareth, I want to come back to that in a little more detail, but to just complete the thought about skepticism of the, you know, the raid story to begin with, you just cited a number of the proven lies that were laid out in the spin zone just a year ago. And the White House did not help its credibility by offering shifting scenarios. As I recall, there were four, if not five, different versions of the events that occurred that surfaced within 2 weeks of this glorious moment. And I think that while it's frustrating for someone like you, because it's like quicksand, there is no foundation to build these stories on, because people don't believe the foundation, figuratively, that you're laying as you expose the lies that were told on that foundation.
Well, okay, I mean, I think it's understandable that these ideas about bin Laden having died a long time ago have cropped up. And you know, this happens in a vacuum, if you will, of information. But I think that one has to use both logic and the full range of documentation of, you know, verifiable facts available to one as an analyst. And based on those factors, you know, first question that has to be answered is, if he had died in 2002 or 2001, are we to believe that al-Qaeda has tried to maintain the fiction of bin Laden still alive all these years,
mm-hmm.
and that they furthermore are happy to have the United States now claim that they killed him without any sort of response? I think that's pretty far-fetched. And so that just at that level, I
mm-hmm.
think that there are strong strong reasons not to to hold this idea that he had died some years ago. And beyond that, I would say that I didn't include it in the story because it went off in a different direction. I now think maybe I should have. I think that was a mistake not to do so. But I know from Shaukat Qadir that ISI did, in fact, verify themselves. They have DNA that they were able to use to verify that it was, in fact, bin Laden's body there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Gareth, I mean, I am inclined to accept what we have been told, I maintain a certain skepticism because of the kind of hall of mirrors that we have been subjected to, certainly before, but most importantly since 9/11. And so it does become difficult, even for rational people who try to make objective analyses and conclusions, to fully trust the information that has been provided. And when you add in the disposal of bin Laden's body and all of this stuff being done out of view, the lack of transparency fuels the suspicions, if not some level of paranoia, about what the official story is and what the real story might be.
Absolutely right, Peter. I think this is this is absolutely predictable result of the constant sort of parade of lies, almost unbroken string of lies about the subject of bin Laden, and so therefore perfectly understandable. And I think what it underlines, this discussion really underlines the necessity for people to work together to try to reconstruct much more carefully the truth in the face of these lies. And again, I would just argue very strenuously that the two things need to be brought into play. One is logic, based on the what is the position of the Al Qaeda Shura on this question of bin Laden, and if there is in fact, there has been no statement from them suggesting either that bin Laden had died earlier, or that that the killing of bin Laden at Abbottabad is a lie, mm-hmm. then one has to ask why. I mean, why would they do neither of these things? And then secondly, we have, a lot of other evidence over the years that bin Laden has still been alive, and I think that that cannot be completely dismissed.
Well, and I would just offer up the young wife with the recent children.
Yeah, exactly.
She certainly believes.
That's right.
That the father of her kids is Osama bin Laden.
But I do want to put the primary emphasis here. I mean, I agree that using the evidence of his still being alive is tricky and requires a degree of commitment that is not going to be. It's not going to be possible for most people to be able to wade through that evidence and sort through it. And I think a lot of intelligent people definitely fall prey to sort of the easier way of dealing with this, which is to say, he must have died a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And so I come back then to those two principles, to the main principle, the primary principle of applying logic, which in this case is why would there not be a response calling the lie earlier by Al Qaeda's leadership, and then again, if it were the case that this is a lie that he was killed at Abbottabad, why wouldn't they say so?
Yeah, and Gareth, unwittingly, because you haven't heard the second segment of our podcast today, but this does relate to the left brain right brain tensions and the need to use your full brain to fully process information and an analysis. So that's an interesting little serendipitous connection. I want to turn to first what I consider to be the corporate media interpretation of these 17 documents attributed to bin Laden and collected in Abbottabad. And I have in the San Francisco Chronicle today about a 12-column-inch story based on this. It is unbylined, but I presume it came from David Ignatius. And I want to credit you with your description of Ignatius, quote, whose writing invariably reflects what top national security officials want to see in the news media.
Absolutely. I mean, he is the primary, the premier, if you will, journalist to reflect the views of the very top level officials. He never deals with anyone at a lower level at all. I mean, he's always the guy who hears it from the top people and accurately, I think, depicts or reflects their views in terms of interpreting every story that comes along.
So what I think is interesting is from the same 17 documents, they drew, they attribute significance to things very different from what you do. And I think that contrast is valuable to our listeners. So they talk about the threats to kill Obama and Petraeus, cast doubt on suspicions that Pakistan and Iran collaborated with al-Qaeda, suspicions about Anwar al-Awlaki held by bin Laden. And that was mostly what they focus on. And then just a little bit about dissension in the al-Qaeda ranks, but nothing related to what you describe as essentially the forced retirement of Osama bin Laden, orchestrated by his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Egyptian medical doctor. And essentially, your findings, supported by the retired military man from Pakistan, Qadir, show that bin Laden was chairman emeritus by the time the Navy SEALs got to Abbottabad, if not well before.
Well, I don't know who the actual author, as you suggested, who the author is of this story, but I do know that some of the earlier commentaries, even before these documents were released, were speculating, and even more than speculating, I would say suggesting that based on information that had been made available by people in the administration, it looked like bin Laden really had not did not have the power that the administration officials, high officials, were claiming at the very beginning, right after the raid, suggesting that Osama bin Laden was clearly the man who controlled everything in al-Qaeda, and therefore this raid is, you know, getting rid of the top terrorist in the world. It's interesting that that began to shift within a few months after the raid last year. There were stories that were beginning to suggest that, in fact, that wasn't really quite true. And so even from the administration itself, perhaps some mid-level people who were not as mesmerized by the official line as David Ignatius was, certainly not mesmerized by the line that was taken by the news media immediately after the raid, were beginning to leak to some people in the media that bin Laden really wasn't in control as it was had been suggested earlier.
Well, and again, this gets into the psychological operations, the propaganda and manipulation spin of information. But once they got bin Laden, to get the maximum political benefit, it's important to puff up his importance and to justify the risks that were taken, the bruised relations with Pakistan for violating their sovereignty, you know, the political benefit of this is greatest if people considered bin Laden to still be the functional leader of al-Qaeda.
Well, absolutely. And this represents, of course, the interests of two entities, the Obama White House and the national security state writ large, and particularly the CIA itself. I mean, those were the interests that were being served very directly by the briefing of reporters right after the raid last year, and, you know, briefings which were simply one lie after another. I mean, virtually everything that was being said in those briefings was untrue, as I point out in my story.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, you know, the power that they were claiming that bin Laden had. But the second one, the second major lie, was that the CIA had cleverly in terms of an intelligence coup, as it was characterized by the senior intelligence official, had been able to move from interrogating these detainees, these high-level detainees, such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks, and other high-level al-Qaeda detainees. They had gotten information which then they had somehow used to follow the trail got ultimately to the Abbottabad compound. And what I learned from my research and with the help of Shaukat Kadir, is that what really happened was that they would not have gotten the focus on the Abbottabad compound had it not been for a tip from, guess who? The Pakistani military and ISI. Mm. And it looks to me like it would have taken a much longer time if they had would have discovered bin Laden at all without ISI to tip them off. And the story that that I tell in detail here, as I think I've already indicated, is that that the ISI started a routine investigation of this compound, or more precisely, of the owner of the compound, without knowing that he, in fact, was the courier for bin Laden, because the guy who was the owner of the compound had been telling people in Abbottabad that he was a money changer in Peshawar,
mm-hmm.
Peshawar, I guess is the correct pronunciation, and that he was doing that apparently to cover the fact that he went to Peshawar once a month and didn't want that to look suspicious. So he was putting that story out, and ISI, being a very systematic, thorough investigating agency, began a routine investigation. Long story short, a couple of years later, it turned out that no, there was nobody by that name, Arshad Khan, which was the name he was actually using, who was a money changer living in Abbottabad. And so at that point, ISI became very suspicious and tipped off the CIA that something was wrong here, and they suggested that the CIA undertake aerial surveillance. I think at that point it was clearly what they expected was that it would be aerial surveillance, not by drones, but by satellite surveillance,
mm-hmm.
so that they could look in on the compound and maybe even try to penetrate it, but certainly penetrate the phones that were associated with the compound and figure out who actually lived there. And that's how the CIA actually decided to spend a lot of effort to penetrate the compound and figure out if, in fact, bin Laden was there.
And I just want to underscore that I used to have great respect for Leon Panetta, and he's a man I've known and talked with on many occasions. But the day that he was seeking confirmation from the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, and he made a statement about how he was opposed to the use of waterboarding. And Kit Bond, senator from Missouri, pushed back really hard and made Panetta eat those words. And I don't know that that was the actual turning point, but on the public record, that's where my opinion of Leon Panetta started to shift. And in the days after the Abbottabad raid, for him to suggest that the discovery of the courier and then the identification of the courier, the tracking of the courier, was a product of torture and the so-called production of intelligence at Guantanamo, I find that deeply offensive. And now I know that it was not only wrong, but gratuitous.
Absolutely, Peter. I mean, what I think we now know is that basically Panetta became simply a stooge for those CIA officials who had supported the torture against detainees after 9/11, and who obviously had a vested interest in justifying that, and used the raid to kill bin Laden as the perfect occasion to try to push their interests. And that's exactly what they did. They got Panetta to go on record in the immediate aftermath, suggesting that, well, maybe those maybe those enhanced interrogation techniques were valuable after all. So I think it really does discredit him. It shows that he had no integrity whatsoever. He became the tool of interest at the CIA, who were compromised deeply by their involvement in torture. And I think that that should be held against Panetta for the rest of his life, and along with other things that are accumulating as Secretary of Defense as well.
Gareth, I don't know if this is going to embarrass you. It's not intended to, but I just have to offer you my deep respect because particularly in sharp contrast to David Ignatius and the stenographers at the Washington Post, you took this limited information released, as we described, on a selective basis by our government, and you went for corroboration. You went for a second source. And this sets such an example, unfortunately a negative one, for the rest of the corporate media. Because in the days since this information has been released, the corporate media has been focused mainly on the woman in New Jersey who is addicted to tanning booths, and I call her the crispy critter. And the coverage of that is not only ridiculous and kind of a freak show, but it shows that the media in this country isn't really interested in doing its job to get at the truth and to questioning the official statements that come from our government. And so I just want to take my hat off to you, because the work that you did to track down Kadir and his information gives our listeners and your readers at Truth Out and elsewhere access to a much fuller story. And well, and that's what journalists are supposed to do.
Well, I appreciate those kind words, Peter, very much. And I absolutely agree with you that the state of the news media in this country as a willing participant in the games that are being played by those in power, particularly in the area of national security policy that I'm covering, is a national tragedy and a farce as well. I do, however, have to set the record straight just to correct one misunderstanding. I did not have access to these documents when I was writing this story. These only have come out since I actually finished the story. So these are two quite separate sets of facts, separate sets of documentation. I was only able to use the documentation that was available, the briefing that was done right after the raid a year ago, mm-hmm. plus the information that I've been able to get through Shaukat Kadir, and basically a few other bits and pieces that have cropped up. But these documents are quite separate, except for what was released, and I think this is why it was confusing, obviously. There were stories that were leaked to the press based on some of these documents, including leaks to David Ignatius, and that's where I think there's an overlap.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This happened some months ago.
All right. Well, yeah. I'll accept that in the interest of further accuracy, but it doesn't change my my description of your work.
Well, thanks again.
What else would you like to add here that you think people should know as part of the deeper story about these events?
Well, I would just emphasize here the fact that there is a deeper story here about the antagonism of the Obama administration, the national security state, if you will, and the CIA in particular, towards ISI. And listen, I'm not defending the ISI on every count by any means. I mean, this is an intelligence agency that has serious problems of its own internally within Pakistan, and may well have been responsible for the murder of the Pakistani journalist Shahzad, who was a very serious journalist covering the problems of jihadist mm-hmm. Movement there and the whole set of issues surrounding that. But ISI is not in bed with bin Laden, not in bed with Al-Qaeda, not in bed with the jihadists in Pakistan by any means. And the hostility that the U.S. national security state has toward ISI is born of two things, and this needs to be understood clearly. One is that the interests of Pakistan and the interests of the United States are very sharply at odds. The security interests of Pakistan and what are termed the security interests of the United States, but are really the interests of the U.S. security state, are very sharply at odds on this question of the Haqqani group and the Afghan Taliban. Obviously, the interests of Pakistan are not the same as the United States in this regard, and it is understandable because Pakistan's interests have to do with its conflict with India. It's still the case that trumps other issues. And so for Pakistan to give up its interest in what is happening in Afghanistan would be very, very difficult, and one would even argue from the Pakistani point of view, foolhardy. And so they need to have allies in that regard, and the Afghan Taliban is indeed an ally of Pakistan in regard to the interest that it has in opposing U.S. and therefore Indian interests in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one fact. The other thing is that the ISI has continued to help the CIA capture high-level al-Qaeda officials and has done so quite loyally since 2001 at some cost to its standing within Pakistan. And the fact that they did, in fact, tip off the CIA to the possible presence of some kind of terrorist in Abbottabad is simply part of the overall coordination of effort to capture terrorists in Pakistan that has been going on since 2001. And I think that it's time for the United States government to own up to the fact that, it has had that help from the ISI and to stop trying to besmirch it in terms of that aspect of the situation.
Finally, Gareth, let me ask you to comment on what is, in context, a fairly remarkable speech in Washington last Monday by John Brennan. And he acknowledged the drone program for the first time. And he offered legal defenses for it that I countered with quotes from the ACLU about how he skirted the actual legal basis for the drone strikes. But he argues that they are legal, he didn't say that. They are not illegal under international law. And he talked about how effective they have been. And if you square the remarks of Brennan with the comments of President Obama in his midnight meeting with Karzai in Kabul on May the 2nd, Obama said that we have killed 20 of the top 30 leaders of al-Qaeda. And Brennan said that we have conducted drone strikes and that 1,400 people have been killed. Now, 20 versus 1,400 leads me to believe that the drone strikes, A, are not targeted only at al-Qaeda, and I think that's pretty commonly known, but the civilian lives that were lost, the so-called collateral damage of people who might have been near an al-Qaeda target at the time that a drone unleashed its missiles, there's a huge disconnect between those two claims.
There's not just a disconnect, Peter. I think it is fair to say that this is one of the enduring long-term lies that the Obama administration is responsible for. That is to say, I mean, they have continued to talk about the drone strikes, the drone war in Pakistan, as something that they're doing against al-Qaeda, when in fact only a minority of the strikes are aimed at al-Qaeda. The vast majority have been aimed at people who are by no means al-Qaeda or even allied with al-Qaeda. Most of these strikes, over the last 3 years or so, have been carried out, and this is well documented. It's not just an opinion. This is something that you can derive even from sources like the Long War Journal, which are very supportive of the strikes. Most of the strikes have been carried out against the Afghan Taliban in Pakistan, or the Haqqani group, which is allied, of course, with the Afghan Taliban and fight alongside them in Afghanistan, but are based also in Pakistan. And so what is really going on here is that the Obama administration continues to justify a program that is extremely problematic in terms of the cost to the United States relations with the Pakistani people long term, by suggesting that it's simply a tool to kill a few al-Qaeda leaders, when in fact what's really happening here is that we're using this as a way of fighting this war in Afghanistan that is certainly lost already. I think every thinking military person in Afghanistan and outside Afghanistan knows that this is a lost cause. And yet they're using this to try to maintain this war, to continue this war, and they're lying about it. They're trying to pass it off as an anti-Al-Qaeda effort. And this is also, I mean, related to what you suggested is the late-night talk by President Obama, where he continued to say that what is happening here is that we're fighting and defeating Al-Qaeda, as though what was happening in Afghanistan is a war against Al-Qaeda, which is simply not even remotely the case.
Yeah. Well, and one commentator, I can't take credit for this, but I'll name her Rebecca Griffin of Peace Action West, who appeared on the preceding podcast following you, Gareth. She said that the photo op in Kabul on May 2nd was designed to send a message to Americans that were leaving Afghanistan and designed to send a message to Afghans and NATO allies that were staying in Afghanistan.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the predominant line there, the predominant message was the message to the American people, which is, you know, that basically he's going to be going into his presidential campaign with the line that we're ending the war in Afghanistan just like we ended the war in Iraq. We will end combat next year. I would simply recall that in the months between September 1st, 2010, and December 31st, 2011, which was when the United States was not supposed to be having any combat in Iraq, 58, by my count, American soldiers lost their lives in combat.
Well, Gareth, we could talk much more. I really value your contributions to our program, and I thank you for the work that you're doing. I want to recommend this exclusive piece that you wrote for Truth Out, and we will talk again very soon.
Glad to be on your program always, Peter. Thanks.
Do you use your whole brain? Women often are right brain dominant, men left brain dominant. Does that make them smarter than me? Well, we'll leave the argument over who's smarter to another day, but today we're going to explore the difference in the lobes of your brain, the left and right, and how they affect politics and policy and other issues as big as war and peace. James Olson joins me here at the Secret Studio. His new book is The Whole Brain Path to Peace, subtitled The Role of Left and Right Brain Dominance in the Polarization and Reunification of America. James, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, tell us a little bit about you. You escaped from Oklahoma well after the Dust Bowl. You've been in California for about a year now. Give us a little bit about your background and when you became intrigued in these issues related to the brain.
Well, I was raised on a farm in northwest Oklahoma in a conservative community. My parents were, I guess, moderates. So I have many friends that have a very conservative view, and that really taught me the conservative view. And I set out to write a book. And while I was writing this book, I attended a weekend workshop in which a neuroscientist mapped the brains of the participants and put us in a U-shaped line so that we could see how left brain we were compared to the other people in our group. And I found myself out near the left end, and that really surprised me because I knew that I had a strong sense of diversity in the right brain, and I wondered how that affected my perception and how it affected my relationships with others being left brain dominant. Mm-hmm. And so I set out to try to understand the difference between the two brains and how this affected my perception and my creation, yeah. my ideas.
Mm-hmm. And you have a background as a management consultant. Is that your day job?
Well, I have a degree in management, uh-huh. and I'm glad I have that because management is really about decision making. And I think of myself as a philosopher, and philosophers manage information. We bring it together into a unified whole to try to bring integrity to the information to eliminate conflict. And so my management training has assisted me very well in the process of gathering information and trying to make sense out of this crazy world we live in.
Uh-huh. Now, you've also explored other things that are kind of out of the mainstream, yoga and different philosophical approaches, Asian or Eastern philosophy. And that seems kind of out of place for somebody out there in the buckle of the Bible Belt.
Well, I went on a junior year program to Vienna, Austria, and that radically changed my life. Mm-hmm. Living in Vienna, I was around a diverse group of people for the first time in my life and was exposed to many new ideas, and I didn't know that there were so many different ways of looking at reality. Mm-hmm. And so that changed me. Now
I've been to Wien, as the locals call it, and it seems to me to be a very left-brain place. So order is important above all else, and emotion and feeling are things that are for the opera house, but not for daily interactions between human beings.
Well, that's true, but actually most of the time I spent was with a group of students from all over the United States in this junior year abroad program. It was a program that did take students from different universities instead of the normal situation in which one university has its junior year abroad program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, for our listeners, let's just give a quick thumbnail. And the way I have managed to retain this information is that I'm a liberal, I'm a lefty. And so it's my right brain that is dominant, presumably. And the left brain is what right-wingers tend to find dominant in their lives. Is that a good, simple, kind of oversimplified bumper sticker explanation?
Yes, it is. The left brain is our conservative brain, and the right brain is the progressive brain. Mm-hmm. There's a dynamic between the two. The right brain is the brain that explores, that knows no fear, and it leads us into new pathways and change. And the left brain is there to give us stability. It's the brain that is responsible for taking care of us physically. It's really, I think of it as our earth brain, mm-hmm. whereas the right brain is kind of the universe brain. And they're a team, and there is a dynamic between the two. They have different goals, and it's our job as human beings, as creators, to find where we fit within that liberal conservative continuum.
Can I use an audio metaphor, if you don't mind? We're currently being recorded in mono, one channel, and it's all mashed together. But the music that I played was in stereo, and there's a little bit of difference of what you hear in the left channel and what you hear in the right channel. And if you take a pure stereo recording back at the recording studio and you separate the tracks, they're not satisfying to listen to just left or just right. You need the full mix of both tracks interacting together to give you the full range of that dynamic effect of the stereo recording. and you may hear a little more drum on the left channel, a little more bass or vocal on the right channel. But again, if you go back to the old Beatle recordings, where it was very stark what was in the left or the right channels, that kind of represents to me the old way of thinking before we learned about the influence of a dominant side of the brain.
Yes, one side does tend to be dominant, and it directs our thinking, and the other acts more as an advisor. And they're very different in the way they see reality and the way they respond to reality. And of course, we can be extreme. We can be extreme left brain, or we can just be moderately left brain. We can be extreme right, or we can be moderate. And it all comes from the dualistic nature of the brain. In the universe, there are two types of molecules. There are polar molecules, and there are nonpolar molecules. And polar molecules are water and substances that dissolve in water. Oil is an example of a nonpolar. Oil and things that dissolve in oil are nonpolar molecules. And there's a tension between the two, and they don't. We all know how oil and water mix. They don't mix well, but they can be mixed. And our brain, the left side of our brain is polar. The right side of our brain is nonpolar. Mm-hmm. And the left side gives us polar ideas. The right side gives us nonpolar ideas. And trying to mix a nonpolar idea and a polar idea is somewhat like trying to mix oil and water. There's a resistance there. But that's what we're called on to do. As consciousness, as spirit, we have two streams of information flowing to consciousness, and it's the left brain's ideas and the right brain's ideas. And we choose who we are. We build ourselves depending upon how we combine these two streams of information.
And James, you just started to define some of these differing characteristics, and you have a handy chart on page 102 of the Whole Brain Path to Peace, where you start off on the left side polar, the right side nonpolar, and I'll continue in that vein. Left individual-oriented, right collective-oriented. Left inwardly focused or self-focused. Right outward-looking, collective self-seeing. On the left views the interiors individually, and on the right views the exteriors as one. I'll ask you to explain that in a moment. On the left, limited. On the right, unlimited. Left, relative. Right, absolute. Left, smaller elements. Right, larger elements. Just two more. Hang in there. On the left, specifics. On the right, generalities. On the left, part seeing. And one of your main concepts of the book is about the whole, W-H-O-L-E. You refer to that, the right brain, as whole seeing. So let's go back to the relative and absolute of the left brain versus the right brain. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, we it's pretty well understood that the right brain sees the big picture. So it sees everything, and it sees everything at once. It's really the God perspective. The left brain is the brain that gives us focus. When we see something in the big picture that we want to know more about, the left brain, the linear left brain, reaches out and grabs that information or starts digging for that information. It goes into the whole and looks at the parts. That's what analysis does. Analysis goes in and takes things apart to see how they work. And so that's the basic difference. And so the whole scene does see absolutely, and in the part seeing left brain sees relatively.
Mm-hmm. And how do they interact and override one another? Let me give you an example. I have a car that tells me I've got 50 miles until I run out of gas. So I'm looking at that 50 miles. I need to drive 40 miles, and I don't have time to stop for gas. So my right brain is going to override the analysis of the left brain that I shouldn't trust that little gizmo that tells me 50 miles because it goes silent after 15 and just kind of leaves me on my own. So I have to make a calculation there. Is it better to take the risk to get to my destination on time, on empty, or is it better to stop and be safe and not rely on the gizmo as to whether I actually will get there without running out of gas?
Yes, the left brain looks at all the details, and the right brain puts all that information together in relationship and helps us come to a conclusion. It sees the big picture. And it helps us in that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a website at thewholebrainpath.com, thewholebrainpath.com. Do you know, are these charts up there on the website?
Yes, they are on the website.
Great. Well, I invite listeners to take a look at that, and it'll help you understand what I've been describing here, reading from the chart, and give you a sense of some of these differences. Now, I'm not a scientist, and I don't think you are either, but give us a quick thumbnail on how recent the developments are of this understanding of the difference between left and right brain dominant individuals.
Well, of course, this is a process that is unfolding as we speak, and it's been unfolding for a long time. This subject was very popular back in the 70s, and for various reasons, it fell into disrepute. For example, one reason, because it was discovered by Ned Herman that we actually have a four-part thinking brain. And so for one reason or another, we got away from brain lateralization. But information has continued to come together. I actually built most of what I found on some very simple information, and that is I looked at how the left and right brains process information. So the left brain takes things apart. The right brain assembles things. So they give us this two ways of dealing with reality. And when you start taking things apart, you get into smaller and smaller holes. And so you're looking inside of things, and that's what analysis does. It looks at the parts of the whole to see what makes it tick. So I was able to come to a lot of to understand what the two brains were able to see from the way they approached what they were seeing. Mm-hmm. And then back this up with science that collaborated what I was finding. And so it was kind of like working on a jigsaw puzzle in which I had parts of the information were there and other parts were missing, but I could partially tell what was going on by looking at the relationships.
Mm-hmm. James Olson with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And I want to turn to the section of your book that I found really fascinating. And it refers to the conservative left brain and the liberal right brain. And I've already outed myself. I'm a lifelong liberal. I've been in the minority for a long, long time now. I find a lot of room to the left of Barack Obama, just to give you a reference point. And so I'm intrigued about how I got this way. And I do believe I use my left brain for calculations and for gathering information. But when I process that and analyze it, I come down on the left 11 times out of 10. So can you explain that to me? What's going on in my head?
Well, it starts with brain dominance. One side or the other tends, as I said before, tends to direct our thinking. But another very important and equally powerful force is the cultural brain, what we are taught by our parents, by our peers, in school, by our government. These factors all come together and to shape us, to make us into who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so you said your left is your decisions. Well, you mean left left being liberal. There's a confusion here because...
No, my right brain is what makes me a liberal, right? It's dominant.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is I do use my left brain because I have skills, skills that, you know, I use every day.
Okay.
And my point is that in the final analysis, in the final mix, my right brain is appearing to dominate because, as I said, I come down with a liberal worldview, and my specific analysis will generally follow that.
One of the reasons that would happen is because you've been reporting the news. You've been looking at what is going on in the world from different perspectives.
Isn't that my left brain that gathers all the information?
It is. The left brain gathers the information, and the right brain puts it together and assembles it. But as you, because of your profession, just as with print reporters or other media, in the process of gathering information, you are expanding your perspective. You are gathering perspective from other people, and that is very enriching in terms of your perception of reality. And the progressive left brain is the direction we are headed. As I said before, the left brain goes out and leads us, and the right brain provides stability. And in the process of gathering information, you expand your perception much more rapidly than the average person. And anybody that is active in trying to understand our world is expanding their perspective more rapidly than other people. So this process tends to make us more liberal. There is a natural progression toward the liberal. Society sometimes shifts back and forth between conservative and liberal. We go to extremes with one or the other. But the overall progression is progressive. We see that in giving women the right to vote, which was a liberal idea at the time. Now it's accepted and it's seen as conservative. And the freedom of the slaves, that was liberal at the time, but now it's conservative. And so there is this progression, and reporters are on the forefront of this. They're out there at the cutting edge, trying to see where society is going, looking for new ideas. And this is very perspective enriching, and that enriches our perception.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we see that reporters are more liberal than the average person.
All right, let me give you another example. John Yoo is in the news again today. He's the UC Berkeley law professor who was in the Bush administration and wrote the memos that permitted what he called enhanced interrogation and what I call torture. And he's in the news because the U.S. Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, rejected a suit by Jose Padilla, a man who was tortured based on the memos written by John Yoo. And the court rejected the claim, giving immunity to John Yoo, who couldn't resist tweaking the victim of his memoranda and his bizarre rationalization for torture by saying, well, he'll have to find other hobbies to pursue during the rest of his prison term. So I find that deeply offensive. And when I look at the same set of information that John Yoo did that caused him to rationalize torture and to redefine it in ways to try to claim that torture isn't torture, my left brain goes crazy, because I'm a stickler for definitions and I'm a stickler for constitutional rights. Yet he seems to stop with his own kind of twisted interpretation in his left brain with, I suppose, what was a predetermined outcome. And I don't stop there. I look at what he did and I say, this is bullshit. And my right brain kicks in and says, yeah, as you analyze this, the information collected by my left brain about torture, about John Yoo and his arguments, then gets processed in the right brain, and it leads to an emotional reaction. I'm angry at what John Yoo did, and that the court dismissed this case, and then he took this opportunity to take a pot shot at a guy who's in prison for another 15 years. So can you help me understand the difference between my left brain and John Yoo's left brain?
Well, the left brain compartmentalizes things. It separates reality and focuses on certain aspects. And he doesn't really want to know the truth. He doesn't want to go into a more liberal perspective because that would threaten him. That would discredit him in his own eyes. And, you know, we're not always honest with ourselves, and we're not all, and conservatives aren't always conservative, and liberals aren't always liberal.
True.
So, but in his case, I'm sure that he doesn't want to get out of his belief. He doesn't want to change his beliefs, because that would be, he would drop a lot of guilt on himself if he did that. And so, but you're open-minded, and you're a more neutral observer, and he's very caught up in that. And the left brain tries to protect us. It not only protects us physically, it wants to protect us emotionally. And it does that through separation, through trying to forget something or cover it up or get away from people that are bringing up these ideas, mm-hmm. or getting rid of the people who are bringing up ideas that threaten us.
Now, James, if I were to submit to a brain scan and that scan were compared to a scan of John Yoo's brain, would it show that his right brain is smaller than mine? Or if we did a brain chemistry analysis, would it show that his right brain is less functional than mine?
Not necessarily. It's just it's a very complex thing, and I'm not even sure how well, because both there's a redundancy to both brains. I'm not sure how well brain scans can work. But he's just following the perspective that he was born with, and
it's his cultural brain that leads him to selectively limit the input that he gets from the right lobe.
Yes, and I should say that the right brain the right brain perspective actually includes the left. The big picture needs the left brain's details, but the detailed brain doesn't necessarily need the big picture, because I mean it does need in ultimately it does need the big picture, because we mm-hmm. need the whole brain. But it can get lost in a focus and think that it sees the whole picture. You know, his focus is on security, and that's number one issue to him. And the left brain also prioritizes, and so he sees it as his mission to protect the United States, and at any cost. There's nothing more important than that, and anything that gets in the way of his job of protecting us and protecting himself is secondary to this goal of getting the information that he believes will save other people.
And so that can even dominate fundamental morality? Because, I mean, that's the problem I have with John Yoo. I think that he is morally corrupt, and that to be able to argue that torture is not torture and that waterboarding, which is widely accepted as torture, is not torture— it takes a suspension of whatever moral center John Yoo possessed.
Well, we can lie to ourselves, and we do. That's a very bad problem that's very pervasive in our culture and isn't given adequate attention. We pay attention to other people, whether they're telling the truth or not, and we tend to ignore our own conflicts, and in fact, conflict starts in the brain. It starts in the difference between the way the two sides look at reality. And if you don't want to deal with the conflict, you can just stay in one side of your brain. You can stay mm-hmm. in the left side of the brain, and ignore everything else going on around you. That's kind of a safe place to be, to hide.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, what I found remarkable about your book is that you were not content just to kind of analyze these differences, but you apply it to some of the biggest questions that we face as human beings, and that is the struggle over war and peace. And I'd like to give you a moment here to talk about your concept of what drives human beings to create a war and to stay in a mode of conflict.
Well, peace is our birthright. It's there until conflict interferes. But, of course, there are many sources of conflict. This is a world of conflict, and it's a tremendous challenge to achieve peace or to regain our peace. And the left brain is the brain that sees conflict. It's it's the brain that's taking care of us. And so it's looking for, it's skeptical. It's looking for problems, and it invites conflict. And if there is, if we are challenged in any way, it's willing to fight for our beliefs. And so we have to understand that we have these two forces working, one for peace and one for war, and we have to decide really what we want in our lives. And sometimes it's easy to fall into the belief that we need to be fighting. I know that my brain leads me there. I'm left brain dominant, and it's always wanting to fight for justice and to fight to support people who are in the minority. And sometimes it overwhelms me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I care so much. And our culture supports this. We have a very violent culture, and we are taught to respond with violence. If someone hits us, we hit them back. We get back at them some way. We're taught this, and we don't have to do that. But it's so ingrained in us, it's hard to break out of this response to conflict with conflict.
Well, and I would argue that often there's no brain activity involved.
Yeah.
in this fight or flight response, where the adrenaline flows and you deck somebody before you have an opportunity to think about it. I mean, that's a fundamental human struggle. And when we expand that to the bigger picture, there are many of us who are critical of the recent wars who feel that we were misled and that the case to go to war was trumped up. I think that's pretty clear about Iraq. And yet we have to live with all the left-brainers who think that it's a no-brainer case, that, we're better off, we got rid of Saddam Hussein and all this stuff. And so it leads to kind of parallel tracks where we have different sets of facts, different sets of beliefs and analysis, and it has led to these incredible losses of money, of human lives, both American and, in this case, Iraqi. And that is rationalized by the left-brainers to an extent that I find breathtaking.
Well, they're just perceiving reality the way they were taught, and the way their brain is showing them, and they're the ones that need to be educated. Right brain people aren't perfect, but they see both sides of the issue to a certain degree, and left brain people tend to only see the left brain perspective and develop left brain ideas. And so I wrote the book to explain the right brain perspective to left brain dominant individuals, because mm-hmm. in order to bring us together, we need to bring the left brain, the conservatives and the liberals together. And I think the progressive people want this. But conservative people are afraid. They misunderstand what progressives are trying to do, and of course progressives sometimes make mistakes. And when we do, they really pounce on that and focus on that,
yeah.
and use that as an excuse to justify putting right brain people in a different. Mm-hmm. Seeing them as the enemy, because the left brain is competitive and it sees an either or situation, and the right brain sees us as a team.
Mm-hmm. No, I can understand that. And James, I'd like you to respond to a sensibility that I have, that we're now in our 11th year of war on the part of the United States, and it will extend as far as the eye can see. Because while Obama made a deal this week in Afghanistan, the deal is that we're going to have troops there until 2024. And there is no end in sight for the so-called war on terror, the war on al-Qaeda. Obama has opened up new fronts in Yemen, in Somalia. We did a dance in Libya. And so I believe that we wake up every day with a burden on our subconscious, knowing that we are in conflict as a nation and as individuals, and that this creates stresses and intangible reactions on the part of us. And to me, it's epitomized when you enter an airport and you are suddenly a suspect, where you now have to prove by taking off your shoes and your belt and going through the Michael Chertoff body scanner that you are not a terrorist. And I believe that this overarching message of fear, loathing, and conflict is a real burden on our collective psyche.
Oh, it absolutely is. I feel it every day. I mean, I'm trying very hard to eliminate conflict using all of my insights. But I'm just bombarded with conflict when I look at the news, and I feel that I do need to watch the news. I mean, I would like to not have to watch the news, but for my personal good. But on the other hand, it's my duty as a citizen to understand what's going on so that I can vote intelligently. We do live in a world of conflict that is very depressing.
Mm-hmm. James, finally, there's much more in the book, including your blueprint for a path to peace, and I encourage people to pick the book up and read it for themselves. But I was pleasantly surprised at the lengthy chapter in your book about the war on some drugs, and I didn't coin that phrase. I have to give credit to a San Francisco Chronicle columnist named John Carroll. But we have, as you point out in the book, a war on selected drugs, but caffeine and alcohol and tobacco are legal products that corporations profit from. And you point out that marijuana as a Schedule I drug cannot be used, at least under federal law, for medical purposes, cannot be properly studied. So the whole hysteria that goes back to the Nixon era of this war on drugs, you find quite misplaced. But how does it relate to the left-right brain separations?
Well, left-brain people focus on one or two issues and they exclude everything else. And there are problems with drug use, whether it's legal drugs or illegal drugs. And so they tend to focus on the illegal drugs because they want to keep the drugs, their cocktails. They still want to have the politicians want to have their cocktails. So they want to focus on the drugs they're not interested in. And it all started when mechanical hemp machinery first became available, and that threatened to allow farmers across the nation to grow hemp, and that would have displaced the chemical companies a lot of money, and the timber industries as well. And mm-hmm. So they really demonized cannabis at that point. And ever since, they have been lying about what's going on in order to protect that. And the thinking, they also, they will tell you they're concerned about their children, and they are, and we all are. And children shouldn't be using any drugs, whether they're legal or illegal. But they just ignore science. They ignore the government science as well as private science that shows that, for example, marijuana and caffeine are roughly equal in the problems that they cause society. So, It's it's the left brain is wanting to, you know, it started out with the left brain, powerful men and women who wanted to protect their timber and plastics industries. And mm-hmm. it continues with people who focus on the damage it does to their children and without looking at the damage that the war itself does on their children and on our culture. I mean, the drug funds fund our terrorists. I mean, it's a tremendous source of funding for terrorists. It creates a disrespect for law enforcement, and that's just immeasurable how the effect of this war on the attitudes of our children toward law enforcement and how they deal with them. And
well, you also cite Michael Rupert's studies in the book about the CIA benefiting from drug trafficking. We know that banks and financial institutions benefit from the money laundering that they do for the drug trade. We know that Afghanistan is the world center for production of poppies that are turned into heroin. And yet the media downplays those aspects of the occupation of Afghanistan and any prospects for it being a self-sustaining independent country in the future. And today we have a report of just another wrong turn in this so-called war on drugs. A student at UC San Diego, 24-year-old Daniel Chong, went to a pot party on 420 on April 20th and got so loaded he passed out and spent the night there, and was there the next morning when there was a drug raid fostered by the DEA. He was thrown into a cell where he was locked up without food or water. They apparently lost track of him, didn't know he was there, and he nearly died. He was in very bad condition when they finally opened the door to this cell and said, whoops. And this is, this is obviously bungled law enforcement. But the fundamentals of this agency and the mission that they have are faulty to from the get-go. And so when you see this kind of a gross miscarriage of justice, it is part of the greater picture.
Yes, law enforcement tends to be male, and our political system tends to be male, and males use the left brain, and the left brain uses force to solve its problems. It uses separation. It puts people in prison to solve problems, and whereas the right brain would try to unify us, and it would also look at the consequences of the drug war and balance the consequences of the drug war with the consequences of greater freedom to use drugs. Mm-hmm. And so we've never had a real debate on this issue, because the left brain side of the culture would lose, because mm-hmm. science is not on their side. Mm-hmm. When you look at the issue, when you look at all of the issues and look at them as a whole, it's just embarrassing how stupid this war is. We're going to look back at our culture many years in the future and wonder why we couldn't see all the damage we were doing to culture mm-hmm. and to ourselves, to our children, to our brothers and sisters, to our parents. That's why I wrote the chapter. I was so frustrated that so many of the issues, important issues, had not been revealed, and I wanted to bring a more holistic, bring my readers a holistic look at the drug war. And I did focus on the right brain side. We pretty much understand the left brain law enforcement side of the argument. Mm-hmm. So and still it was a long chapter, and I left things out. I couldn't get everything in I wanted.
James, finally, we opened this segment with the song "Man Smart, Woman Smarter," and you write in the book that women tend to be right brain dominant and men tend to be left brain dominant. Is the path to peace some sort of shared power where women are co-equal with men, not dominant? Because I do understand that, women, these are gross generalizations, but, that there are benefits to the left brain. It's not something that we should simply overpower and suppress. But is it your argument that a more co-equal power share with women would lead on a path to peace?
Yes, the path to peace is found in the right brain, and that's the brain that dominates the thinking of most women. But we need to use our whole brain, and that's why we can't just let women take over, because men tend to see the details better, and we need both the details and the big picture. So we really need both brains at work if we're to remain competitive as individuals and to remain competitive as a nation. There are other people, like the Chinese, are more balanced in terms of their use of the brain, and we need to start using our right brain more, and that's why I wrote the book.
James Olson, the new book is The Whole Brain Path to Peace. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Drop me an email. Let me know what you think. And do use your right brain. Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.